I call this meeting of Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. With that, I will start with the approval of minutes for February 28, 2023. Chair Fisher, did you want to move the approval for minutes of February 28?
Yes, Chair, I'd like to move the approval of the minutes.
Fisher moves the approval for minutes for February 28, 2023. Discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for February 28, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we have a couple of bills before us today. So we will be strict on time so that we are able to complete our task ahead. So we have the first bill, and this is House File 135. Representative Vice, welcome back to the committee. We have had the discussions on this bill. Please, I will move that House File 135 be referred to Children and Families Committee. Please welcome to the committee and introduce your bill.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So before COVID-19 struck, the Twin Cities region was grappling with surging homelessness. The pandemic exacerbated the problem, but also brought new resources to address it. Hennepin, in partnership with state, local, nonprofits, and federal funding, Hennepin County invested significantly to fund homelessness solutions in an effort to prevent homelessness and move Minnesotans into permanent, stable housing. Hennepin County focused the investment on deeply affordable housing for those with the lowest incomes and people experiencing homelessness, including $45 million to shelters and support services programs to swiftly move people out of homelessness to new housing opportunities. This investment, however, is primarily one-time money, Hennepin County faces a financial cliff in 2024. Homelessness is a statewide problem and needs a state solution. House File 135 will provide the ongoing sustainable funding to maintain the shelter service models that better serve people and ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, and non-reoccurring. And I would also just like to highlight the fact that Hennepin County, many of the people in shelters in Hennepin counties come from greater Minnesota. This is off the top of my head, but I believe it's 40%. And my testifier can tell me if I just made that statistic up. And with that, I will turn it over to the experts.
Thank you, Representative Chen. All representatives.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chen. I'm David Hewitt, Director of Housing Stability at Hennepin County. As you've heard, the strategy at Hennepin County is to make homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. Simply put, this means that we need more people to exit homelessness than enter homelessness in a single day, in a single month. As has already been shared, what we saw in pre-pandemic from the period of 2016 to 2020 was the opposite was happening with regards to unsheltered homelessness. We saw a 377% increase in unsheltered homelessness across that period. And this is where we have the greatest concern from fire, infectious disease, violence, and exploitation, and also the form of homelessness that has the greatest impact on overall public health and public safety. As you've heard, the pandemic both exacerbated the need to respond, but also created resources enabling us to do so. Hennepin County, we invested deeply out of initially CARES funding. We used $26 million in local funding to purchase hotels to convert to affordable housing. We invested $46 million in affordable housing recovery, and $45 million in pandemic funding towards the homelessness recovery. In all, almost 40% of the pandemic recovery funds we received have gone to housing and homelessness. Some of the specific services that has been supporting these last couple of years include shelter diversion. In just the first month of this year, this service, helping people find safe alternatives to shelter, helped 100 households avoid entering shelter, reducing the numbers coming into homelessness. Low barrier shelters. These funds made possible the creation and operation of Avivo Village and the American Indian Community Development Corporation Homeward Bound. These two shelters have served hundreds of people coming directly out of encampments and have helped hundreds move on to permanent housing, treatment, and other positive destinations, creating space for others to move in. New shelter development. We have two existing providers with a need to redevelop their sites. There's a chance here to seize the moment and really bring in transformative purpose-built shelter services. 24/7 shelter operations. Before the pandemic, there was only one single adult shelter in Hennepin County that allowed people to stay throughout the day. We have transformed that. It is now about 80% of the shelter beds that allow people to stay during the day. That is not only more humane, but it supports better outcomes, especially when paired with the last point here, housing-focused case management. We've worked closely with an advocacy group known as Street Voices of Change. people who have experienced or are experiencing homelessness. Their number one priority working with us on their shelter bill of rights was to introduce case management. Just a little over a year ago, we created a new case management team at Hennepin County, and in that time, they have moved just over 400 people directly out of homelessness into permanent housing, about half of them coming directly from the streets. So that was 400 fewer people than would have been on the streets or in need of shelter during the most extreme weather events we've had recently. What you see on this slide is a dashboard created for us by HUD, Technical Assistance. What it does is it compares the rate at which we were moving people out of homelessness before the pandemic across the community, so all of the programs combined, with the rate since we began those investments. The green line there is the period before the pandemic. The purple line starts in October of 2020 when we started making these investments. In short, what you see there is every single month since that point, more people have been exiting homelessness for permanent housing in Hennepin County than before. And we've stayed focused on the hardest to help, the folks with the longest histories of homelessness and the highest barriers to housing. We've also accelerated the rate at which people exit chronic homelessness, people who've been homeless on average 4 years. In actual fact, what you see on this slide represents over 5,000 cumulative years of homelessness ended by people moving into permanent housing. What is not on this slide, but I want to share in addition, is that we have a 93% success rate and that 93% of these folks have not returned to homelessness since being housed. This really plays into our belief that ultimately everyone is housable. With the right supports, everyone can be successful in housing. And here is a result. I know in earlier sessions you've heard about point-in-time counts. With some caveats, it's not a perfect data source, but it's pretty good for trends and trajectories. The 2022 point-in-time count for the federal government in Hennepin County was the lowest ever. They started in 2005. We were way below then, the lowest ever, and it included a 24% reduction in unsheltered homelessness, a reversal of those steep increases we saw before the pandemic. But we need to continue this, and that's not guaranteed. That's not a given. And we can look at the alternatives. Here is just a snapshot of how we compare to some other communities around the country. I've left off the big ones, the LAs, the San Franciscos. But if we look at ourselves and compare using census and point-in-time data with, say, Alameda County in Oakland, what we see is a rate of unsheltered homelessness more than 10 times that in our local community and growing. So for those of you who have experienced or seen encampments in Hennepin County, imagine that times 10 and a half. Imagine 10 more encampments for every one that you've seen. That is what is being faced elsewhere. So that brings us to our ask. Very simply, we're not looking to replace the $13 million that we put in every year as a baseline for funding. We're not looking to replace the $16 million extra we will put into family shelter this year because of surging demand. We're not looking to replace the millions of dollars that our nonprofit partners raise. What we are looking for is a partial match with the money that Hennepin County has invested in transforming this system so that the services I've just described don't have to stop in 2025. Because that's the alternative. It's people back on the streets during the day as we end 24/7. It's those shelters that I described no longer being available, those supports no longer being available to keep people exiting housing, homelessness for housing. Emily Bastian from Avivo can't be here today. She is actually at the National Alliance to End Homelessness Conference on Unsheltered Homelessness, another sign that our local efforts are being recognized nationally. But this is a video of the folks who are in Avivo Village as they exit on to permanent housing. They have a ceremony where they ring a bell each time they do. I wish we had the sound. You would hear the applause, the cheers from their fellow guests. But I'm going to let that run just for a second while I hand over to Mike Gozzi of the American Indian Community Development Corporation to finish our testimony. Thank you, Mike.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. I'm Mike Gozzi. I'm the CEO of American Indian Community Development Corporation in Minneapolis. American Indian Community Development Corporation has been dealing with homelessness within the American Indian community since 1992. In my 15 years of being at the lead of AICDC, we have seen the numbers increase. There are several reasons for that, but the numbers do increase. Homeward Bound was the result of an ask by the community for a culturally sensitive, a culturally based homeless shelter, a 24-hour shelter that would meet the needs of our community and provide opportunities for our community members to work with community members to provide those services, and we're very successful in doing that. In 19, I'm old. In 2022, we had 483 people that went through our shelter. In 2021. In 2022, we had 433 go through that. In working with our clients, we are able to provide services to help people get into permanent supportive housing, temporary alternatives to housing, and also institutional housing or programs that meet the needs of the individual people. And that should be our goal in all the work that we do. We are looking forward to continuing our service. We believe it's valuable to the community that I serve, the American Indian, Native American community in Minneapolis, but it's also good for the whole community. It shows that working together, working with our people, we can provide the outcomes that are needed for success, and that's what we all work to do. And I would just like to say that Homeward Bound has filled a need that it was in the community for many, many years. And that need still continues today, and it will continue tomorrow. And we're asking for your support in making our work continue to meet the needs of our community. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. So with that, members, I just wanted to note that on the 19th of January, we adopted the amendment. So it's in your packet, but we did adopt that amendment. We'll come back to the motion later on. Member discussions. Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question for, I think, Mr. Hewitt that was testifying before on the information you were presenting us, which we greatly appreciate. And just want to get a little bit of background. The very, very encouraging chart that you have about the historic trend of reducing homelessness and getting people housed in a permanent way. What do you do to look at this data to make sure that it's not just people are becoming more invisible that are housing insecure and homelessness, but that you really know that there's been a reduction and not just data?
Yes, Director Hewitt.
Thank you, Channel Representative. The specific count, well, we referenced two data points there. One of them was on exits to permanent housing. That is information gathered by all of our providers and entered into the shared homeless management information system. So that is gathered by organizations like Mike's, teams like mine, as they are collecting that data. So it's person-centered, it's individual by individual. This individual that we are working with exited to housing today, and it adds together that data of everybody that got moved into housing. So that very robust, real-time data being shared across the community at an individual level. The point in time count data is the federal count. We have adopted a number of strategies. We get better at counting every year, but it's not perfect. It is possible that there are people who are invisible. We do more every year to search that out. More particular efforts in recent years have been getting out more to rest stops, people in vehicles, that kind of thing. We work with all of the outreach teams. Where do you know where people are? We do for days afterwards, and I did a couple of these shifts myself, we go to drop-in centers to say, where were you on the night of the 27th, in case we were not where you were, so we can count you as well. So we really, although it's a one-night count, the efforts last a full week. They involve everybody in the outreach world, and we bring in volunteers from across the community to participate in the count, so it has great visibility and that robustness. I would always say it can be better. But what we can say is it gets better every year. So we feel confident that it is a predictor of trend and trajectory more than absolute number, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Chair Pratt, thank you. Just wanted to follow up on that. The Coordinated Entry Homeless Assistance Program that at the county, how is that really helping you with what you just stated in terms of the work that you do?
Thank you, Chair. I know we're tight on time here, so I'll try and answer that quickly. I mean, the coordinated entry system is essentially a way of managing scarcity more than anything. It's just a way of prioritizing people for the housing that becomes available. And so, for instance, when we look at how many people were housed out of chronic homelessness, those people who've been homeless for 4 years apiece, our ability to prioritize them is because we have a coordinated entry system. We're able to say veterans, people experiencing chronic homelessness, people with disabilities, people with medical fragility. These are the first folks we have to house, knowing we don't have enough housing for everyone. But to that point of, like, how do we get more people into housing, that's the things I've described. It's having a robust shelter system. It's having case management. And it's continually working with our providers to increase the quantity, quality, and variety of permanent housing programs in the community.
So does that mean that we also do place individuals in multifamily units in different places so that you can help? Thank you so much. Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Hewitt. I will be honest. I am shocked by your presentation today. And I'm hoping you can shed some light on this for me. Frankly, even our Minneapolis delegation has expressed some pretty significant frustration about how homelessness has been handled. And so I'm a little bit shocked to hear and see a pretty significant change. And so I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit more about specific things that you have actually done differently in the last couple of years to see these significant changes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Absolutely. I mean, some of the things that we've done differently have been embedded in here, but of course there's more detail behind them. I mean, I will point to, and the thing that I take the greatest pride and greatest solace in has been the impact of housing-focused case management. And we really started seeing the impact of that in the pandemic when we were the second community, we believe, in the entire country to move all of the seniors out of congregate shelter and into hotel-based shelters. We don't have anyone in a hotel-based shelter today. What we did very quickly was we said, this is expensive, it's unsustainable, let's get every single person here a case manager whose goal is to get them into permanent housing. At our height, we had 540 people. We moved 464 people to permanent housing, and we were out of that business. But we saw the impact of that model, and we said, well, let's keep doing this. Let's build up the team, and let's start working with folks in unsheltered settings. Let's start working with folks in sheltered settings. That was about a year ago, and we've moved another 400 people. It is that personalized one-to-one approach with individuals focused urgently on getting them into housing, paired with, on the other side, working with organizations like AICDC. In the last year, we've had Wakayagan 3 open, new permanent supportive housing. Catholic Charities Endeavors opens, more permanent supportive housing. So it's at the same time, it's investing in the growth of our housing stock, investing in the growth of rental assistance. We've had the emergency housing vouchers through our public housing authorities have been an incredible resource. And our community is at 90% leased up, only taking people from the streets and shelter. Around the country, the average is about 50%, but we're at 90%. Because of that case management, we've been moving people into these resources much more quickly than before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just also like to add that there are other cities in Hennepin County that are benefiting from these types of programming, including St. Anthony, which is one of the cities that I represent. Just wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. I don't feel like we have time to delve into all of it, but I would love a deep dive on this to understand better, because I feel like the picture we were getting just a year ago and 2 years ago was very, very different. So it feels a little shocking. I have one more question for Mr. Hewitt and then one for Representative Feist, if I can, Mr. Chair. You said you used the number 460 that you moved into permanent housing. What are we considering permanent housing? What do we consider permanent housing?
Director.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. Essentially, somebody is on a lease. This is their place. It's not time limited. They can stay as long as they want. Most commonly, it is housing in the private market with rental assistance and support services as needed to help that person stabilize. In other cases, it may be a site-based unit, a building that is dedicated to this purpose, like those I referenced earlier. Often, it is with a rental assistance voucher from the Public Housing Authority. But essentially, it is their home, their place, they control it, they get to close the door behind themselves. This is theirs, is the main piece there. If I may make one comment just on the kind of the difference in the story that you're referencing, Representative New Brindley. I mean, I think part of the challenge that we have faced as a community has been the very visible most high-impact form of homelessness continues to have a terrible impact on communities and an even more terrible impact on the people staying within these settings like encampments. And that, of course, brings it to the forefront of everybody's attention. It's one of the reasons I use the slide comparing ourselves to other communities as well, because our trajectory is not as fast as we want. 487 unsheltered is still 487 too many for us. So we are by no means saying we are satisfied with where we are, only that our trajectory has been reversed compared to where it was heading, and we need to continue on that path.
I think the time for this bill is over for us, but if you wanted to do a quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that number, 487 unsheltered, there's so much more I want to talk about, but I guess I won't know because I don't want to lose my, I don't want to lose the floor for a moment, but I'd be curious to know how much shelter space we have available and how that's being filled and how this bill will affect that. I will just say, once again, and I know I have been a broken record on this, but I'm very concerned right now, not with the fact that we are spending money, but with how we're spending money. And this would be to Representative Feist. I'm very concerned that we're spending far more in the tails and in the base than we are up front. And right now we have a ton of one-time money that could go into the shelters. In fact, we'll be hearing a bill on the floor tonight. But we don't have nearly as much ongoing money, and we have a ton of needs, and I'm very concerned that you're choosing to spend more money in the tails, which is not money that we have to spend right now. That's not under our purview right now. And yet we are choosing to spend a lot more money in the tails than we are up front when we have over $12 billion of one-time money. That's confusing to me. It doesn't really make sense, and it doesn't seem fiscally responsible or prudent. So I will leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Preview for the floor debate. So Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative New Brindley, for your comments. I do believe that this is incredibly responsible and important funding. As Mr. Hewitt mentioned in his introductory comments, homelessness has like vast implications for all aspects of our lives, from infectious diseases to public safety. And these are investments that we need to make sustainable so that programs like Hennepin County's, with their 93% success rate, can continue to do that important work, move on this trajectory. So I believe this is looking long term, and I believe that's the way that we should approach our budgeting. Thank you.
Quick comments from Representative Palm and then Gilman, and then we'll go to the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One, if we are having success and you saw a lot of bell ringing, then I would think the tails would not be increasing, they'd be decreasing. It'd be nice when you did your charts, you had, you know, that we're getting more. It'd be nice to see the percentages, because we really need to on there also know they're higher, but is that because we've got two times as many people, et cetera? And we could also see the differences across the months. I would have liked to have seen comments about you've analyzed, you show a chart with a bunch of different locations, analyzing the successes and the failures there. So we're aware that, yeah, California messed up with this and we're not gonna do that, those type of things. And then, well, I'll hit next bills with more questions. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 135 as amended be re-referred to the Children and Families Committee. Are all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. You are on your way to Children and Families Committee. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 1686. Representative Collins, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1686 be re-referred to the Children and Families Committee. With that, please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Knorr, and thank you, committee members. It is really an honor to be here today to present House File 1686. This bill is a result of collaboration with over 60 public, private, and nonprofit partners who align their work to ensure that homelessness in Ramsey County is rare, brief, and non-recurring. For those members who were in Prevention of Homelessness Committee last biennium, you'll remember Ramsey County being held up as a model of how to address homelessness, and this is a continuation of that model. The collaborative approach and alignment is essential to addressing the unique needs in our community, and the support of this bill, in this bill of $75 million for use over a five-year gap, will help achieve a more sustainable and effective system that will reduce the need for ongoing investment over time. The funding will be used to provide shelter and services to families, single adults, youth, and individuals with complex needs. It will also help expand and create new or enhanced adult and family overnight shelter, day shelter support, and outreach and infrastructure to move more people into a path of permanent housing. This investment is needed to bridge the gap from the end of the COVID funds utilized by Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul to the completion of new affordable housing. The leadership of our local leaders is nothing short of remarkable, and I am so pleased to have the chair and vice chair of Heading Home Ramsey, Deputy Mayor of St. Paul, Jamie Tincher, and my very own County Commissioner and Ramsey County Board Chair, Trista Matas Castillo, here to share more about our local story and the importance of the legislature support this session.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, committee members. I'm Trista Matas Castillo. I'm the chair of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners and the vice chair of the Heading Home Ramsey Continuum of Care. Heading Home Ramsey Continuum of Care is an organization that represents our entire community. It is not just Ramsey County, but the 19 nonprofits and community partners that also participate in Heading Home Ramsey. And I'm really excited to be here with other homeless warriors here today who have really addressed the needs of their community. I think it's important to remember that each community is slightly different, and we've approached the issues of homelessness individually and uniquely. And in Ramsey County, we took a slightly different approach than in Hennepin because it fit the needs of our population here. We currently have a gap of about 15,000 units of housing that are at the 30% AMI level, so very low income families. We don't have enough affordable housing in Ramsey County, and that we have about 2,600 people currently on the waiting list at coordinated entry. So the need is really high. This is something that we take very seriously. And together, and because we're kind of answering some of the questions that were asked earlier right up front, and I appreciate questions, is that we, together with the City of St. Paul, Ramsey County, invested $74 million of our CARES and ARPA money into affordable housing so that we can immediately go to take care of those tails. We want to make sure people actually get to housing. But in the meantime, we have to shelter people where they're at and appropriately, and so that's why we are here today. As you know, the housing crisis continues to grow for lots of reasons. Homelessness is on the rise, and we certainly see it here in Ramsey County. You all have these slides. You can read them. I'm not going to go through every slide because I want to get to your questions, which are really critical, and respect your time as well. In Ramsey County, we have a very diverse population. I think some really important factors about Ramsey County is we're the smallest county in the state of Minnesota, and we have the most concentrated poverty in the state of Minnesota. We're the 10th densest county in the entire United States. So if you think about our size and population, our only means and asset to raise money in Ramsey County to invest in these programs is property taxes, and less than 50% of our land is even taxable because we house all of you here at the state capitol and all the other services and programs. So we have a unique situation here in Ramsey County, and yet we're also the second largest in population needing to meet the needs. During the pandemic, we were able, because we had an inflection of ARP dollars, to invest in shelter differently than we had in the past, which was unique that we are also able, because of the pandemic, to change our model. So we went from the lottery system, wait for a shelter, hope you get a bed or a mat tonight, to having rooms with doors, with 24-hour security, with wraparound services for individuals. And what we saw is that the outcome of people being stabilized 24 hours a day and culturally appropriate and specific to their needs is the increase in success rate. It went from about a 3% success rate if you're stuck in the shelter system and constantly looking for where you're going to sleep tonight and access to programs, to a 66% success rate to permanent housing in just an 18-month period. As you saw, we also had encampments during the pandemic. We had the highest number of people sleeping outside in Ramsey County than we have ever seen. At one point, it was 485 folks sleeping outside. And I can tell you that myself and Deputy Mayor, who is not able to be here today because of a family emergency, were out in those encampments and made sure that every person received the care they needed that was specific to them. And to make sure we could bring them inside and then create long-term stability. This change in the model that we know works came with a larger cost up front. So we have already, as I mentioned, we've went upstream, we've invested in the money for permanent solutions, but this upfront cost is what we're asking for. We are asking for $75 million. That's $14.5 million a year that we are planning that we can meet the needs where the county and our other partners can continue to sustain the rare, brief, and non-reoccurring situations of homelessness. But we have this bubble that has kind of occurred, and we have a population that needs to be housed and sheltered appropriately. So that's what this ask is for, and as we move upstream to address affordable housing. I just want to share, invite Randy Roth, who is one of our community partners and a member of our Heading Home Ramsey Continuum of Care, to share part of how that model changed and the outcomes for her families. Randy Roth from Interfaith Action St. Paul.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Roth, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Randy Roth, R-O-T-H. And I serve as the Executive Director of Interfaith Action of Greater St. Paul, which houses Project Home, the shelter I'll talk about. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let's take a close look at one of the shelters whose fate is tied to this bill. For roughly 20 years before COVID, Interfaith Action's Project Home provided shelter to families with children in Ramsey County. 54% of our guests are under the age of 13. We provided shelter before COVID by rotating through houses of worship. Two churches or synagogues at a time would host 20 beds of shelter each, 40 beds total, for that month. And then on the first day of the next month, we would drive our vans up with the cots to set up at the next church. It all worked fine. In some of the churches, the family could have a classroom. In some of the churches, the families all slept on one church basement floor with cardboard dividers. But we made it work. But then COVID hit. The governor issued an order closing all houses of worship, and we had 40 people sleeping over that night. So in the hours, weeks, and months that followed, we tried many different solutions. With tremendous and courageous help from both Ramsey County's leadership and from the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, we ended up in a situation that turned out by data, which I'll share in a moment, to be much better for the families and children than what we had been doing before. After participating in the most well-attended Ramsey County Town Hall meetings ever, and after having the newspaper headline be YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, we were able to move into the Provincial House, which had been the former convent of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, adjacent to the St. Kate's campus. So here we are, moving shelter into a beautiful, high-income neighborhood. Who does that? And it's working. I'd love to take any of you on a tour. We have 100 real beds of shelter in private rooms for families with doors that lock. The sense of peace and safety is palpable. It's well-maintained, clean, sunny, filled with artwork. Every floor has a sunroom where the kids can do homework. We have a computer lab on the fourth floor where the families apply for jobs. And here's the key to our success. As soon as the families move in, we help them focus not just on their stability in shelter, but on their family's economic mobility. Our Rapid Exit Social Work team helps them figure out how to achieve their goals for better jobs, housing, transportation, childcare, and more. Here's a few key statistics about how much better it is now that we're in a building rather than on the basement floor. Our average length of stay, a key metric, decreased from 84 days to 66, making room for many more families in a year. We follow our families for 6 months after they move into their housing, and although the data is not perfect, 96% say their new arrangement is working at the six-month mark. With 100 beds and 30-plus families at a time, we are within striking distance of eliminating the Ramsey County shelter wait list for families, not for singles, but for families with children. With no significant revolving door, the same families are not coming through over and over again. I'd like to take one more minute, if I can, to tell you the story of one family. Are you good? Great. Shauna, a 44-year-old mother of two teenagers, was diagnosed with brain cancer. Her mother, Rita, moved in with Shauna and the two children to help care for the family. Shauna went through radiation, chemo, several surgeries. She lost her job, and as a single mom with low income, she went through what savings she had in the months that followed. And in November 2021, the grandma, the ma, and the two kids lost their apartment and became homeless. They were placed in Project Home. Shauna's brain tumor came back while they were at Project Home, and she had another surgery and more chemo. But in that time, our Rapid Exit case management team and family advocate staff helped Shauna apply for and obtain Social Security disability and personal care attendant services. Our staff also helped Kira, Shauna's 19-year-old daughter, get a good job in her chosen field, a job that would pay for her to get further training to make more money. And our staff helped Marcelo, Shauna's 15-year-old, to thrive in high school. With the stability of shelter, with daily meals, snacks, free laundry, on-site tutoring 4 nights a week, his attendance and grades improved in school dramatically. The family got an emergency housing voucher. Our staff helped the family find a landlord willing to take that voucher. We helped them move in, and they've been in their new home since October and are doing well. I'll point the committee members, please, to the support letters in our packet, and thank you so much for your time and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, member discussion. Representative Gilman.
Thank you. This is a much different picture than our last situation. I'm just curious, with the rapid exit team, how did you, do you mind me asking how you, Chair, how they came up with that process? And do you collaborate, you know, with other metro cities, you know, something like that, and helping support, looking at individuals uniquely, if it's mental health, substance abuse. There's so many things that are available, even through Zoom, AA, Al-Anon, you know, just NA program, just different things that people can find support with what maybe could lead to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman?
Yep,
thank you so much for the question. Our entire agency focuses on first stability and then economic mobility. And it's based on national models that have been launched in the Deep South through the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the Kresge Foundation, and we're doing this both within Project Home and within our Department of Indian Work, which serves the entire East Metro. So you have to be stabilized first, but then we bring in every kind of wraparound service that we see that the families need.
And so just one follow-up question. Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much. Have you gone back to then your synagogues and your churches as well as faith-based folks. Like, I'm encouraging people back in my community, how can we get involved, you know? And it's not just coming to the state and the taxpayer dollars. It's really coming back to our roots and our communities and how we can step up to the plate. So I'm just wondering if you've gone back to church support, and what does that, or synagogue support, and what does that look like?
Ms. Brooks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, yes, thanks so much for the question. We have a full-time Presbyterian minister who's our director of congregational engagement, and every day he's meeting with churches and synagogues and mosques to try to get them to engage more deeply. So we have houses of worship doing the weekend meals so we don't have to pay staff to do that. And we have houses of worship doing diaper drives and helping in every way they can, tutoring, other services with the kids. It's just that we learned that by the families having a stable site to sleep over at, that that was really helping.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the presentation, and Representative Hollins for the bill. I do have a couple of questions. One, I just want to say, you know, you didn't go into this a lot in the presentation, but we heard a lot about this over the past few years. And I will say I've been very impressed with Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul and the approach. And they've done a really, really good job of funneling people into an appropriate lane. And I understand that there are still some problems with, there's a very small number of people for whom it's difficult to find an appropriate lane. And so I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit, in the bill language, it talks about developing and operating a Familiar Faces pilot program, and it seemed like maybe that was what that's addressing, and I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about what that would look like.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. The Familiar Faces program is specifically to what you mentioned. There's a group of people that are our highest users of other services like police, fire, EMS that are very expensive and maybe not the right response, but when we have someone in a mental health crisis or other issue, they're hard to respond. So this is, and they tend to be the same people over and over. They're familiar faces to us and those of us who are on the ground. And so this pilot would be the creation of specific spaces for them that we can do intensive wraparound services and put them in a right place. There are people that don't fit into other shelter spaces because they're disruptive to the people there. And so we need to have a space specifically for them, and that's what that would be for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So am I hearing that this would be an actual facility or a day facility? It
could be a combination of both. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley. It could be a combination of both. So it would be addressing to those individual needs. Some of them might be able to get a single room occupancy that just has more care. They might be able to get other services. Some might require, maybe we have a small facility that we can put a few in, but it would be addressed specifically to those needs, which is why it would be a pilot at this time, so that we can learn and grow and develop what would be appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And my last question would be to Representative Hollins. Again, I have had really good things to say about this program in the past, and I really do give a lot of kudos to Ramsey County and the City of St. Paul, because I think they have put in some intensive work to figure out how to do this right. And they've clearly shown success. And I would also say, interestingly, the presentation you gave also seemed to paint a realistic picture, which I appreciate. I'm skeptical sometimes of data that we get, and this felt accurate, and I appreciate that. My question is two-part, all about the funding. So this is funding for 23, funding for 24, and I appreciate that. I think that is a good, positive thing, and used over 5 years. So I think you said it's about $14 million per year. Is your intention with that then is that you'd have this funding over that five-year period? And that you'd get some things figured out in that time, or it's just up to the next legislature then to figure out additional funding at that point? That would be part A of my question. And part B would be, On line 2.1, it says Ramsey County may use up to 10% for administrative expenses. I'm a little bit concerned that that amounts to $7.4 million, and that's grant administration. These are grant programs. That seems very, very high for administrative costs in a relatively short period of time. I can't imagine that they are going to require that much staff time to administer these programs. And so I'm hoping, Representative Hollins, that you might consider maybe a smaller percentage there moving forward, just to make sure that this money is going where we actually want it to go to. So those would be my questions, but overall, I think this is great.
Representative Hollins, those are two questions.
Thank you, Chair North. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. I barely remember the first question at this point, but I can say the second question, I am willing to discuss and negotiate on how much the administrative cost is. We know that it is a slightly higher administrative cost than you would normally see, like that 2.5% to 5%, just because some of these programs are going to be new and they are very administrative heavy. But I think we're willing to talk about that. And for the first question, I think, yeah, the commissioner would like to answer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative New Brindley. You had the first question, you kind of answered it in your question. Our plan is, because we have gone upstream to invest in affordable housing, to get that number of units online, we need about 5 years, and which is why we've really calculated and planned that out thoughtfully, is that's how long it's going to take to bring enough units online to be able to stabilize. I'm not saying we're going to end homelessness in Ramsey County, because it is a situation that people experience at different times, but that it would put us back into a level that we can go back to our system of the county with our community partners being able to stabilize the capacity at that time. I think it's important to remember, too, as I mentioned, we kind of have this bubble right now. Less than 42% of people that we are currently serving in our shelter program actually identify as Ramsey County residents. They come from all over the state of Minnesota for services, and there has been a long time fight about sending people back to different places. But they're in so much trauma and crisis in that situation that we took the approach of, let's serve people on behalf of the entire state of Minnesota who are here right now and stabilize them as a part of the greater good. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great use of one-time money.
Thank you.
We have two more individuals, and then two members, and then we'll go to vote. Representative Zelezny.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Hollins. I, too, want to say thank you. What I was really impressed with is the housing piece of the stability of housing, we all know, is obvious. But what I liked hearing is the economic mobility. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I'm looking to hear, is how are we doing pathways to, you know, not to further advance people to their furthest potential, and to be a part with those wraparound services and how they're working together. Mm-hmm. That to me is the thing, because then the person's moving out of that model into a productive place to society for their own self-confidence, own self-esteem, their own personal goals, and then that bed becomes used for somebody else that is in that place. And it becomes not a lifestyle, but a short-term transition model into a pathway. And I love what you're doing with that. So congratulations, and look forward to seeing what it does. Thanks.
Thank you for your comment. And the last question on the list is Representative Johnson. Just a quick comment.
Actually, it's not a quick comment, so I'll just take it offline with Ramsey County. Thank you.
That will be great. So
that it's your birthday gift, yeah.
Yeah. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
All month long.
It's Thursday afternoon, so with that, your closing remarks, Representative Pauline.
I know we're, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the conversation and the discussion, and I'm happy to continue having those conversations with folks. The one thing I really wanted to recognize and address is that what I'm really proud about from Ramsey County and a St. Paul perspective is how our elected officials aren't scared of getting their hands dirty. Like, I have talked to multiple of them that are at the homeless encampments, that are having conversations with individuals who are in the throes of mental health crises, drug addiction, families that are really in need. And I think we hear from a lot of folks at the legislature, but especially when I see people who aren't afraid to
like get in there and be a part of those communities and really like learn and hear from them. That's what inspires me and makes me feel comfortable moving forward with this amount of money, which I know is a big ask. But it's because I think we're really doing the work to get it done. They are really doing the work. I'm just asking for money. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Collins and Commissioner Ms. Rock. With that, I renew my motion that House File 1686 be re-referred to Children and Families Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The motion prevails. You're on your way to Children and Families Committee. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2138, Representative Hicks. Please move the bill and introduce the bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee. I move House File 2138 be referred to Children and Families Committee.
With that, please introduce the bill and continue.
So there's a theme today about the bills. So Chair and Committee members, Olmsted County is a growing community in Minnesota. Rochester, which is our biggest city, is the third largest city in the state of Minnesota after Minneapolis and St. Paul, and houses the state's largest private employer. Mayo Clinic brings in people from around the world and is an economic driver for Rochester, but also for the state of Minnesota. Patients are discharged if they do not have lodging, many times to homelessness, despite the work of our Mayo Clinic social workers and staff who are working really hard to try to solve housing needs for these folks. We have a unique population that comes to our community for medical care, sometimes through the emergency room, because they haven't been able to access it. Once they're stabilized and need to be discharged, if there are not the necessary, if they do not have the necessary financial resources to meet their needs, we struggle to support and accommodate. They find their ways into our shelters, and we are a very fortunate community, grateful for our community partners who have really stepped up to help us address our homeless needs, but we continue to have needs. We come before the committee today to ask for a very small one-time appropriation. Like many of the other communities, like we heard of today, we have seen the needs of our unhoused neighbors continue to grow. This year, Rochester Public Schools saw a 31% increase in students experiencing homelessness. In Olmsted County, our current eviction court is out 2 to 3 months and behind schedule with 15 to 20 evictions per week. Emergency assistance in Olmsted County is already run out and will not be replenished until July 1 of 2023. The Rochester Community Warming Center is at or over capacity most nights. It is my hope that with these additional one-time funds, we can work to ensure that Olmsted County can meet the needs of our community, increase our base ability to support our needs. And with that, I turn it over to my expert testifier from our county.
Okay, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dave Dunn. I serve as the Olmsted County Housing Director, and I'm thrilled to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 2138. I'm thrilled that Representative Hicks has moved this bill forward. Just to give you a little bit of background about Olmsted County and some of the work that we're doing, I know you've heard a lot of you've heard the theme today about unsheltered homelessness and different responses, and I think we're taking a little bit from both approaches as we move forward. But just to tell you, I know Olmsted County and Rochester is a very fortunate community, but we have needs. We have 9,600 rent-burdened households in our community. So those are households that are paying more than 30% of their income in rent. So those are households that are one bad day, whether that's a car issue, a medical issue. Inevitably, it happens. That it is enough to send many of those households over. And I know one of the numbers you've heard is statewide that there is only about 25% of the housing choice vouchers or rental assistance that's needed. In Olmsted County, that number is only 15%. We only have 1,400 units of rental assistance for those 9,600 families that would qualify. So we do have, we're a very fortunate community, but we do have needs. And so we appreciate the assistance of all of our partners in creating a homeless response system. We have been looking at both the Hennepin-Ramsey and other models over the last few years. In 2019, we really didn't have a system set in place. You started to see families and individuals sleeping in our skyways, just becoming much more visible as in other parts of the community. And really what we've collectively done is we've worked together to build a system. We've worked together with Catholic Charities of Southern Minnesota to create a shelter, which was the first time we had an all-day, everyday shelter in Olmsted County. We've worked with The Landing, which is a new organization that's created day center services, so we have places for people to be during the day, and we've enhanced organizations like the Salvation Army and the work that they've done. Along with that, Olmsted County has invested significantly as well. We've invested in staff resources. We've created what we call our housing stability team. I call it our team of rock stars because they go out every day. They're working with people in the streets and across the community who are struggling with their housing to do what they can to make sure that they have the resources available to them and are aware of what is possible and what are the different opportunities that they may have. We've created what we call an Echo Center, which, again, we all love our great government acronyms. And this one is Enhancing Connections Through Housing Outreach. So what we did is next to our warming center, there was a vacant bay in a strip mall. Instead of leaving it vacant, we actually put two full-time social workers in there. So at any time, we essentially have a drop-in center with a telephone number and an email address that people can call all day from Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 and have conversations about their housing needs. We've created new housing options, both temporary shelter and long-term, with over 200 new units of rental assistance for people who may be experiencing homelessness. Long story short, we have been working hard to build a system in Olmsted County, but in order to continue these investments, we need just a little bit of help. And so that's why we're here today. We have more work to do, and we're excited about the successes that we've had. It really comes down to that combination. I know that you've all heard today about housing and case management. In a lot of ways, I think in different kind of formats and different opportunities, those are the two magical ingredients. And when you put those together, when you have housing options and opportunities and you have someone to kind of make those connections and work with that individual on what those needs are, you have those ingredients for success. And so I just want to thank you for your consideration and allowing me to testify today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. From the other member from Olmsted County, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and some of the information that I was interested in didn't see in the presentation. Of the funding, what percent is for operations, what percent is for supplies, and what percent would be for facilities?
Mr. Dunn.
Yes, of the funds that are available, we would essentially, we're taking this as $420,000 over the annually for the biennium for short-term shelter. So what we're looking at there is to provide that assistance to our Rochester Community Warming Center and to our family shelter that we're looking to establish to make sure that we have what we need there. There's another $420,000 that's really looking at more of that longer-term shelter and transitional housing. So one program that we have created is, we call it the CREEK, but it's a 90-day extended day shelter that's really been successful. And so enhancing those programs along with hotel vouchers, because we know that in spite of all of our efforts and everything we're doing in the community, there continues to be a need for that emergency shelter option.
Follow-up,
Representative. Actually, the question was percent for operations. That's personnel, electricity, utilities, et cetera. Percent for supplies would be food, toiletries, that type of thing. Facilities would be fixed, you know, making accessible, remodeling, fixing, or acquiring, and offline you can maybe get that information because that's helpful. The other stuff is like right here, I can read it. How much of the homelessness is seasonal? How much is for medical, as was touched upon? How much is temporary, such as there was a fire, the mobile home community had storm damage? And how much is long-term? And then the other clarification would be local, you know, percentage homeless are local, other parts of Minnesota, from out of state, neighboring states, you know, other states, and then foreign citizens, because I know we have repeatedly over the decades had refugee populations in Olmsted County. When you were mentioning the different services and groups who are helping, I know the Lutheran Services had a youth and young adult program, and I don't know if that's gone away. And then you have in your bill tribal governmental unit. What specific tribal government or entities has the county been talking to? Because I don't think, I'm not aware of facilities. I know they have purchased land, but I haven't heard of any development. Thank you.
So I'll just answer the quick tribal question. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair. Thank you. We put that in there as Elk Run is coming, and they've purchased the land, and we're waiting for federal approval, and we just didn't want to leave them out if that were to come through and we were to need to, you know, collaborate with them. That was sort of a maybe, you know, if we need it, we wanted to make sure that the county had the flexibility to do so.
Mr. Dunn, do you want to follow up? I'm sure you will be able to provide some of that information to Representative.
Yeah, some of it will probably connect offline, and I'll kind of share, but just a couple of points. Is kind of who is experiencing homelessness in Olmsted County. About 70% of our people who are experiencing homelessness have been there for more than 2 years. So they are people who have been here locally, which is, again, when you talk about homelessness and the issue of it, part of the complexity is that it's different everywhere. And so when you hear about different locations, so I know that's one of the things that we hear a lot about is that do people just come from the region to Olmsted County? And the answer is a few do, but most of them are people who have been here that we've been working with for some time that we continue to try to provide assistance to. And one thing, I know one number on here, you know, we looked through our coordinated entry system, and at one point in time, we have 1,002 people in our coordinated entry system who at least one night in 2022 were unsheltered. So when you talk about it, you know, locally that it's an issue. Now, on any given night, that number is much closer to 200. But again, as people rotate through and they're suffering from housing insecurity, those things do tend to vary. The other part of it is we just don't have, you know, the best data we have is still not good enough, and we're continuing to get some of that. So I'll work on some of those numbers as well, probably offline, in order to make some of those connections.
Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps my questions are along the same lines, but maybe just a little bit more pointed. I'm just wondering looking at the language to fund and support shelters and services, and then to maintain and expand programs and facilities. Are you intending for this money to go into hard assets for shelter space? Is your intention for this to provide programming and wraparound supports? And just to make sure I understand the language, there's the breakdown, the BCDE, the different paragraphs, the $420,000 each year for these different things. Is that, I assume that's coming out of that $1.2 million per year. What exactly is your intention with that funding?
Mr. Dunn.
Yeah, I think it's a little of all of the above. So as we were talking about earlier, we're still kind of creating our system. So I can give you one example right now. I hope, cross my fingers, that next week or in the next couple of weeks we'll be able to close on a building that we hope to have as our first family shelter in Olmsted County. So that, as we look at this funding and an allocation of it, probably helping to make that facility operational is certainly going to be something that's probably more on the physical asset side, but also looking at operations. So I think there's some flexibility there, knowing that with our service providers, just to make sure that they have that operational opportunity to remain open and to provide the services. So thank you for the question.
Final follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. That makes sense to me that you are still creating the system and figuring out exactly how this is going to work, and there might be some flexibility with that. I appreciate that. I would encourage you to talk to the folks at Ramsey County, because I've met pretty extensively with several folks, and they've done a really good job at, like I said, funneling people to where they need to be, what is most appropriate. And they know people by name, which I think is really, really significant. So thank you for what you're doing.
Representative Hicks, with your final remarks, and we'll go to vote.
Yes, thank you, Chair and committee members. I really appreciate the support for this. Olmsted County, like Mr. Dunn said, we didn't really have a system that was working as well as we do now in 2019, but we're still in our baby stage of developing a system that's going to work for our community and for southeastern Minnesota. And so we really appreciate the support to help get us there and hopefully learn from the successes of others so that we can be successful.
With that, Representative Hicks renews her motion that House File 2138 be re-referred to Children and Families Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. You're on your way to Children and Families Committee. So thank you so much. We have the final bill, and members, we have less than 23 minutes. House File 908, Representative Agford, you're welcome to the committee. I move that House File 908 be re-referred to Judiciary Committee. I see you have A1 amendment. Did you want to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
I move A1 amendment to House File 908. Members, this is Horton's request. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? See none. The amendment is now adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. So I'm here to present House File 908 as amended. So this is a bill to ensure that our nursing home workers are providing the best service for Minnesotans living in nursing homes. This is also a bill to help address the staffing shortage crisis we're seeing in nursing homes since the start of the pandemic. Unfortunately, we aren't going to be able to solve that crisis and give our nursing home residents the care they deserve until we address the crisis of compensation for the frontline essential workers who keep nursing homes running. This bill aims to do that by creating a nursing home workforce standards board. This is an old idea dating back to the Great Depression that's getting new life around the country as a way of bringing workers and employers in a specific industry along with their regulators to hopefully work together and improve both wages and working conditions for those that are caring for our loved ones. And in the case of nursing homes, that means stabilizing and growing the workforce to meet the needs of employers, improving resident care, and doing so in a way that supports the state's goals of world-class care for an industry that receives 80% of its funding from the state. This bill would create a 9-member board appointed to stagger terms by the governor as required for a rulemaking body. Those members would include 3 employer representatives, 3 worker representatives, along with the commissioners from the agencies of Department of Health, Department of Human Services, and Department of Labor and Industry. The Nursing Home Workforce Standards Board would be charged with investigating market conditions that would require direct engagement of workers and employers so that the board has appropriate information to set minimum standards for wages and working conditions through rulemaking. These rules are meant to be reasonably necessary and appropriate to protect the health and welfare of nursing home workers. As we've amended the bill, we've clarified which workers and employers the Workforce Standards Boards would apply to. The bill now also further discusses how the board must take into consideration VBR estimated costs when determining its standards. So it would do this by comparing the employee wage and benefits portions of the actual VBR rates for the coming year with the forecasted rates for the employee wages and benefits a year later. If the standard costs less than that increase, it can go into effect without additional funding. But if that exceeds the increase, it either needs to wait for a legislative appropriation to go into effect, or the board can roll back the proposed standard to come within the allowable increase. The labor standards established by the board would be enforced through the Department of Labor and Industry's existing authority, as well as a private cause of action modeled directly on the one already in place in the state's Fair Labor Standards Act. The board would also be charged with reviewing the standards it advances at least once every 2 years to ensure that they are up to date. To ensure that workers are aware of the board's process and how to participate, as well as of the standards set by the board and their rights, duties, and obligations, should this bill become law, the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Boards will be required to create a training curriculum to be delivered by worker organizations certified by the board once every 2 years, and employers will need to
provide a notice developed by the board to their employees in whatever manner that they already use to provide other worker-related notices. Finally, this bill ensures that workers are protected from retaliation for exercising their rights under this bill, including participating in board proceedings and trainings. And just for some general context, a similar bill passed the House last year in the HHS omnibus bill, and this year it's also the governor also has a similar proposal in his budget. We all know how critical this industry is to hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, and we also know that this industry is struggling. And we have an obligation to provide for the care of our seniors, but until we address the crisis of wages and working conditions in our nursing homes, we will never have the workforce needed to provide that care. Creating a nursing home workforce standards board is a proven way to address that crisis and give these essential workers who spent at least the last 2 years that we've been praising a voice to in helping to determine those minimum standards in partnership with employers in the state. And with now, I'll turn it over to our testifiers, Mr. Chair.
I think I have Travis Bett, the first person on the list, and also if Toby and Aaron can come close by so we can have all the testifiers. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Nora, members of the committee. My name is Travis Berth. I am a server and a cook at Serenity Care Center. I am here on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare in Minnesota of Iowa. Our union represents about 50,000 healthcare workers around the state. We work in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We support the Nursing Home Workforce Standards Bill. I started working at Serenity in December of 2020. I was one of the few to start in the middle of the COVID epidemic. But I guess you could say I was born to work there. My mom worked in assisted living when I was young. I volunteered with her. Later, she became a cook at Serenity. I decided to work there when I got out of the Army, mostly because I didn't have a car. My mom could drive me to work. I didn't choose Serenity for the pay. I got hired at $12.50 an hour. After more than 2 years, I still only make $14 an hour as a server. That is barely above the minimum wage in St. Paul. I qualified as a cook, but I still only make $17 an hour for my cook shifts. It is easy to find safer, less stressful jobs that pay more. I interviewed with an HVAC company that would pay $20 an hour. Unless you give workers in this industry a chance to set a better minimum wage, we will never attract the workforce we need. I thought boot camp in the U.S. Army would be the worst experience of my life. Boot camp was not that bad compared to working in a nursing home that does not have enough staff. When I work weekends, we have just two servers for two whole buildings. Together, we have to feed 160 people. We have to get the meals prepared on the tray line. We have to distribute the trays in the dining room. We have to clean all the dishes. We can't do it on time. We are usually 30 minutes to an hour late, but then the food is cold. Some residents miss meals completely because they have a medical appointment. Residents get angry and yell at the staff. I don't blame them. We feel miserable being late. Every day, some coworkers break down and cry. They say, why stay at a job where you feel terrible every day? When we get new employees, they almost always quit. Even our long-term staff quit because they can't take it anymore. The short staffing is worse now than when I started during COVID. I feel like I can take it better than others because I have been in the Army, but what does that say about this industry? Margaret was another cook. She was a longtime friend of my mom. When I started, she took me under her wing. Because of her, I moved from server to cook. We would try to support each other when the job got tough, but she got too stressed out and couldn't take it. She quit because of understaffing. Without her, my job is even harder. But I don't blame her. I'm thinking about getting another job too. I am not a policy expert, but I can tell you what it feels like on the floor of a nursing home. We don't get treated with respect. Our managers pay us as little as they can and get away with it. I have had 3 administrators in 2 years. The problem is not just lacking of funding. the business press says lots of people are making money from nursing homes. More of that money should go to the workers on the floor. To get more money for workers, you have to give them the power to set standards. I am lucky. I have a union, and I get a voice. But too many workers don't have that chance. The bill wouldn't give them a union, but it would give them some say. All we want is a chance to sit down with them and build something that gives our senators the care they deserve. Please vote yes and support House File 908. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Brett. We now have Toby Pearson and Erin Huppert. Welcome to the table, both of you, and we can start. You can start with your testimony. Please introduce yourself to the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Huppert with Leading Age, and I am here on behalf of the long-term care imperative. My colleague, Mr. Pearson, will provide comments on the second half of our testimony today. First, I would like to acknowledge the chair, his staff, proponents of the bill, and Representative Abaje. Since the bill had its first hearing in labor last week, we've met a number of times to work through the proposal and address our concerns. And we've made some progress on that end, but we do remain opposed at this time. I would also like to acknowledge the testimony of Mr. Berth. He is absolutely right that he and his colleagues deserve a wage that supports raising a family, that elevates and recognizes the dedication he provides to our seniors. You heard testimony on a bill, House File 733, a couple weeks ago that is aimed to do just that. In terms of our concerns, they can be broken into three main categories. First, governance, structure, and duties of the board, which we hope to more fully address in state government committee. Training and duties of certified worker organizations, and then payment and finance. And so for the purposes of today and for this committee, we'll focus our comments there. House File 908, as amended by the A1, is intended to require that any standard that requires funding beyond the November forecast of the preceding year be authorized by the legislature before a standard goes into effect. Unfortunately, the A1 doesn't address three critical problems that we are still trying to work through. First, the forecast is a global estimate. So for example, this year's forecast produced an average 9.4% rate increase for nursing homes. But again, that's an average. Some received more and some received less. So the A1 does nothing to ensure that standards set by the board can be met by the 350 nursing homes in the state and their 350 rates. Second, the November forecast used to effectively certify, for lack of a better word, sufficient funds in this amendment, it relies on two-year-old costs. Therefore, it's not a current representation of the nursing home sector's financial picture. By extension, the VBR rates produced in January of each year are used to support a nursing home's existing costs. So that means for most nursing homes, they can't be tapped to cover new expenses without making a reduction somewhere else in their budget. Finally, the A1 amendment does nothing to address the compounding of the gap or the lag that exists between when a nursing home submits a cost report and its rate. So should a nursing home be mandated to spend its current rate on new standards without a new appropriation, we end up making that lag that exists even worse. So I will now turn it over to my colleague who can give two specific cases on how the A1 really plays out.
Thank you, Mr. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota, today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. To pick up where Ms. Huppert left off, I'll walk through two cases that try to attempt to illustrate our concerns. First scenario is kind of a typical nursing facility. On January 1st of 2023,
The operating rate is $270 per resident day, which is an increase of about 8% from the previous year, where it was at about $250 a day. Meanwhile, the actual operating costs on January 1st, 2023 is actually $290 a day. That's because costs of care for seniors have risen in those intermittent 15 months, and you don't get reimbursed for those right away. Reminder, all of the cost reports and all of the rates are based on allowable costs that are audited from cost reports. These are all submitted to DHS for verification. Now, under House File 908, as amended by the A1, let's say that a workforce standards board is in place and creates a standard that increases cost to that nursing home by $20 per resident day. The A1 would argue that because that standard fell within the forecast and the rate increases received, it would not require separate legislative appropriation. However, the operating costs for that nursing home are now $310 per resident day, and the rate reimbursed at the nursing facility remains $270. So you have, in fact, exacerbated the challenge that a nursing home faces in covering its costs. That nursing home will now be forced to comply with the standard and then not use its rate to cover other operating expenses, which could be food, therapy, other labor. Interestingly, that $20 will be forced into the rates eventually. So the board actually would have taken a measure that will force the increase in the rates that the legislature has not approved any money for. Mm-hmm. As one other example, let's assume the workforce board creates a minimum wage for CNAs at $25 an hour. If you rely on the global estimate, it would be about $13.60 per resident day for nursing homes. But if you're a nursing home that has been incredibly challenged and your starting wage is $16.50 an hour, you would receive $138,000 less than needed for just that position. That doesn't include all of the other effects on your hiring and your positions within your facility. That's just that one position. In essence, in its current construction, the SEIU Standards Board can, and according to language, must take action through rulemaking that can, and more than likely will, increase state spending without any legislative oversight. That relates back to the function of how the voting is done, where if you have three members that are appointed by the governor, three members from labor, and three members from the industry, the industry could, in essence, say, we have a lot of problems with this, we object, and still be outvoted 6-3 and have that board pass something into rulemaking. So all of these things can take place over provider concerns without reference to anything that a provider may or may not do. As Ms. Hubert said, we've been working regularly and meeting regularly with Representative Agbaje, thank you very much for your time. The chair and Sean, we know that this is very difficult. There's a lot of details to work through. The bill and the proponents, we really want to resolve our concerns and our issues so that when this bill comes back to this committee, we're able to sit here and tell you, yes, we all support this and we can all live with this. Unfortunately, we are not there right now today.
I will open up for member conversation or discussion. Worker Zilla-Sneaker.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Baje. I, too, have been very concerned about nursing home staffing. And so to the testifier who works in dietary, thank you for coming today, because my son also worked in dietary and said it was the most stressful job he ever had. If you have to remember what everybody drinks on 60 plates, and settings and make sure everything's right. Seniors don't like any disruption. And understandable so. They're a huge infrastructure. While I understand the intent of this, I think we need to get back to the basics for Minnesota. We have to mandates. Nursing homes have been straddled with mandates. In the 40 years I've been in nursing homes, I'm a nursing home administrator. I've watched mandates get added, and the costs go up, and it's a direct cost. 80% of the costs that are in the cost report, when you look at data, it's labor. And so nobody's getting rich in the nursing home business. It's not a profession. Actually, people are going to close nursing homes, and they're going to – there's not going to be buyers. They're just going to close because they're not exactly a business portfolio people are looking to invest in right now because the reimbursement rates aren't there. So we have nursing homes right now at risk of closing. We have 300 nursing homes in Minnesota, and in the time I've been a nursing home administrator, I've watched that drop at a fast pace. And so – mandates are sound good, but it's very short-sighted thinking. And I appreciate what you're doing, Representative Baje, but I want to see us invest in wages for the staff, get the wages where they need to be. The market will drive this, and it will right-side it. The thing we can do is look at what, and I met with DHS today, and I have met with MDH. We need to look at the fines and how we're fining facilities at nursing homes and assisted livings and figure out a coaching method and a method to create opportunities for high school students to get credits while they're coming into nursing homes so that they can become CNAs and child care workers. So I understand the intent. I prefer to come at it from a different angle to accomplish the goal of having care, because what's happening right now is these mandates are just going to have allegations of neglect and abuse, which have nothing positive happening except more people leaving the field because the care plans aren't followed, because we already know that we don't have enough staff. And so raising the reimbursement, which the state is a major player, the player, in how we fund, and we haven't gotten that across the finish line. If that happens, we will accomplish what we need in Ely, so that facility doesn't close, in Roseau, in Proctor, all the towns that we have, big and small, and the facilities will be able to create a masterpiece for their community at a time when we have the largest group of seniors aging. Mandates aren't the answer. It sounds great, but it causes a lot of cost. So I urge you to listen to the representatives from the associations and get the wages adjusted. These wages need to be adjusted. We've waited way too long, and we're seeing the repercussions. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author of the bill. I guess, again, I'm, it's all about timing sometimes around here, and I think that your intentions of making sure that our amazing employees that are working with our most vulnerable adults, really, are still in this transition period of going through enormous changes with regulations with assisted living, nursing homes, a couple years ago. And about 4 or 5 months ago, I visited with one of our care centers back at home, and they showed me about the regulations that they're looking at now, the federal, the state, Minnesota Department of Health, the surveyors that show up when there's, issues that pop up. Typically, they're self-reported mistakes. Sometimes they are something they have to recognize. But there is not an industry out there that is more highly regulated than this industry. And although your bill is well-intended, I just want to make sure that we really need to pass the Edelson bill first before we even sort of embarrass ourselves to the nursing home operators out there that are looking at us right now going, what are you doing right now? And so to that, Representative Agbaje, can we try to pass that other bill first before we really take this thing on? I want to be honest about this. I'm not opposed. We've got some delay issues with funding, as we heard from Mr. Pearson. But I'm wondering, is this something that can we get the other thing ahead of us first to show our nursing home operators that we're really seriously giving you more tools to work with, and then maybe we can approach something like this?
Representative Blake, I think that bill resides with us, not this bill. The 908 has been.
I'm asking your opinion. Yeah.
I don't know if she even knows what that bill does, so I don't want to ask her opinion. Something that she has.
Mr. Chair, I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. You know, I am not super familiar with that bill. I do understand this timing issue of providing funding. I will just want to clarify, though, that. With the amendment, what the board is doing is actually going to take a forward look at the estimates that VBR and that nursing homes already provide to that equation. So then that way they're meeting the estimates going forward in the future. This isn't really about looking back. The other thing I also want to clarify is that the authority of this board is limited to those conditions that affect the workers in the nursing home. So this bill doesn't actually really have any authority over additional standards or supposed mandates of care that's happening. That would be something different. This is really more about the accountability for the wages and costs and how funding is being spent in that labor-specific space. If DHS is around, if they want to talk more about the formula, I'm happy to welcome them to the floor. But I just wanted to at least make that clear that this is about really the labor conditions for the workers as it relates primarily to cost.
Mr. Chair, and again, I guess I'm wondering, I haven't, and maybe you're hearing other things, but I haven't heard enormous amount of complaints outside of what we control, which is the funding to our nursing home partners, in that I think that what I'm hearing is they're doing everything they can to manage the rules with the very limited dollars that they're having. And this is going to be, again, another sort of a operating board, I think this is really entering an area that we shouldn't be going into when I don't think there's a problem here. There could be a oversight board for every single industry out there, and I think that we're creating ourselves more issues, more bigger government. We don't need to be doing this, especially if we just keep it simple and provide the funding that we need to do. This, members, I think is a very not well thought through. I think we really need to listen to our advisors out there that are telling us in testimony today that this is not ready. We do need a lot more discussion about this with DHS. Maybe now isn't the time to bring them down and ask a lot of questions, but I think we need to really dive into where this is going. Are we going to fix the lag time, number one? Are we going to get the reimbursements where it's ahead of the game? And then maybe we can look at a standards board. But I have great concerns about this, members. Thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, is the intention, I should rephrase here. Do you view the bill in front of us as a, in order to get the Edelson bill passed, funding for nursing homes, which is what I think ultimately we all want to see, I would hope. Do you see that this bill in front of us as a requirement? If we want the Edelson bill passed in order to see rate increases for nursing homes, we also have to have this House file. What is the House file? This one that's in front of us here.
908.
Yeah, 908. Is that the intention?
Well, I don't know what the pathway is. Right now, this bill is going to judiciary. We have 733, which is in the jurisdiction of this committee. So we will have more discussion about the budget because we just got the February focus. So hopefully things are going to move quick and fast when we talk about the budget. So for now, I think we will have to focus on 908. And come back to the conversation on 733 on another day.
Correct, but Mr. Chair.
Representative Franson.
Yeah, so this bill, 908, also talks about using this board, which it seems to me, I see that there's the unions are in support of this bill, the executive branch is in support of this bill, which no offense to any of our hardworking union people in the nursing homes, okay? Not every nursing home belongs to a union. But this bill, it appears this bill is acting as a statewide union negotiator. And
what I'm thinking is going to happen is that if we want the Edelson bill passed, it's going to be part of 908, and that's not what I want. I just want clean funding to our nursing homes without it being tied to something else.
I'd like to give it to the bill because of my question.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to clarify again. This bill is about creating a workforce standards board for the nursing homes that's focused on their costs and the accountability and having accountability over those costs. The board has three members from both agency, for regulators, from employers, and from employees. The way that the board could decide on situations that are in front of them could go a myriad of ways. The agencies and the employers could all be on the same side on an issue. We may even get it at a point where employers and employees are on the same side opposing the agencies, or a myriad of ways. They can address the situation themselves. But what we're trying to do here is ensure that workers, employers, and the agency and the regulating agencies can all be at a table working together, creating industry-wide standards. So then that way there's less that there's more uniformity across the board. And so I have been talking with the industry, and you know, I think we kind of understand that basic point, and so getting there is what we're working through right now. But one of the things we want to make sure is that we're creating a board like this, that other states have also created similar boards, where the workers have a stronger voice, that they don't have to go one by one by one as their each union. And so that's the purpose of this bill that we've proposed.
Just wanted to give the final comment to the lead, New Britain, and then we'll go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. This is what I am concerned about. What was just said. Frankly, I'm never convinced by the argument that other states have done it. We see other states do all kinds of stupid things, bad policy. But I'm actually concerned about this idea of making it more uniform. Frankly, that is the benefit of a union, is that they have the power of collective bargaining, and that they get to do that in their facility, in their jobs. And this actually takes that away from them. This takes that power out of the individual collective bargaining unit and hands it over to this statewide board. I would also suggest that, frankly, we're talking a lot about nursing homes, but I think every single one of us understands that the problem is they don't have enough money. I don't think there is any employer, any nursing home administrator who does not want to give their people more money. And I think every nursing home administrator would be thrilled if we pass legislation with money, let's say it has to go to wages. Like, let's force that issue. I think everyone will be thrilled to do that. But the bottom line is we're creating more government with more costs to tell us what we already know. We need to pay these people more because they're not being compensated. And that's the crux of the issue. And, we talk about worker standards, other working conditions. Those conditions are not going to improve until we have more workers. That's what creates difficult working conditions, is when we don't have enough people to do the jobs. And I say this as somebody also, ironically, I also started as a dietary aide in a nursing home. That was one of my very first jobs, and it was how I entered the world of working in nursing homes. But we're trying to create something really complex for an issue that is just not complex. We know what the problem is, and we know what the solution is. The question is, are we going to do it? So while I understand and appreciate the fact that you're looking for solutions, sometimes we can just play checkers. We don't need to play chess. Sometimes we can just play checkers. And this is one of those situations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. With that, I renew my motion that House File 908, as amended, be referred to Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Budget, you're on your way to Judiciary Committee with no further agenda items. We are now adjourned.